The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
I see Trump, his presidency, the fact that he was elected in the first place as a symptom of a crisis of legitimacy of American global supremacy. Trump, when he ran in 2016, was roundly decried by the foreign policymaking class in Washington, both parties, as an isolationist. And it seems as though voters either didn't care or felt that that was exactly the confirmation they wanted, that Trump would truly be different once in office. In actual fact, I think he hasn't been all that different, and he also ran always promising to build up the supposedly depleted U.S. military such that we now spend more than the next 10 militaries combined. So, you know, he's not really an anti-interventionist, but certainly he has appealed to that sentiment in his runs for office. So I think this long-term trend will continue.
I'm Jack Goldsmith, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 27, 2020. I sat down with Stephen Wertheim, Deputy Director of Research and Policy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He is the author of the new book, Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy. We discussed the surprising World War II origins of U.S. hegemonic militarism, the changes in what it meant to be an internationalist during this period, and the domestic political origins of the U.S. embrace of the U.N. Charter. We also discussed the relationship between Wertheim's book and his work for the Quincy Institute, a think tank devoted to fostering U.S. military restraint. It's the Lawfare Podcast, October 27, Tomorrow the World. So, Stephen, thank you so much for chatting with me today. I loved your book, and I learned a ton from it.
Oh, thanks so much.
Your basic thesis is that what we now think of as natural U.S. global militarism, armed primacy around the globe, that it was a choice, and it was a kind of a self-conscious choice, and it was made in a particular period of time, I would say from 1940 to 1945, and for a particular set of reasons. So is that a fair statement of the thesis, and could you elaborate?
I think it is. I think that it's pretty uncontroversial to say that the founders of the United States, certainly George Washington in his farewell address, did not articulate what we have today as a goal of the United States, even an aspirational one. To the contrary, Washington in that particular statement said that the United States should avoid making permanent alliances with any part of the foreign world. And yet today we know we have a consensus around having the largest military in the world, and not only that, but policing the world or enforcing world order on a global scale with a forward deployed military. So my question was, how did we get from here to there? At some point, it wasn't just the materiality of American power that changed, but there must have been a conscious decision that was reflected in American political discourse as well.
So I'm going to ask you later about whether it wasn't just what you just described as the materiality of American power, because I'm going to at least suggest later on that by 1945, the United States was in a position militarily and otherwise where global militarism made sense. But let's push that off for a second and talk about the ideas side of this. And so let's just walk us through the argument. It begins in 1939, 1940, and walk us through how and why the ideas changed, what the previous set of ideas were, and how and why they changed during this period.
Most Americans are used to thinking of the United States' rise to global power as an ascent out of isolationism and into internationalism. I saw a very different story. Coming into the 20th century, a lot of Americans identified as internationalists, but they didn't identify against isolationism. They didn't even use that term as an epithet to describe their opponents. The question for this generation of internationalists was, how should the United States relate to the world in a way that will avoid or even overcome the system of power politics centered in Europe? And it turned out that, you know, that aversion to making extra hemispheric entanglements was only made more popular by the experience of World War I and the looming of a new general war over the course of the 1930s. And so when World War II breaks out in Europe toward the end of 1939, there are very few Americans who foresee the United States getting involved in that war or who think it would be a good idea for the United States to do so, much less to become the dominant military power after the war. There are post-war planners who get started. Of course, the United States is not in the war at this time, but in the State Department and in the Council on Foreign Relations, they get started very quickly to sit down and try to ascertain the shape of the world to come and what role the United States might play in it. And through the period of the so-called phony war from September of 1939 to April of 1940, they expect that World War II in Europe will be kind of a repeat of the last war. It'll be something of a stalemate. And they're thinking in traditional U.S. terms, perhaps the United States can mediate a settlement in Europe. And in fact, the Undersecretary of State, Sumner Welles, is dispatched to Europe in the spring of 1940 to try to do that, including to try to bring Mussolini's Italy to the side of the democracies. It doesn't work. And the post-war planners at this point are spending their time thinking about schemes for universal disarmament after the war. And they changed dramatically because of a very specific event, the conquest of France by Nazi Germany within just 6 weeks in May and June of 1940. And that shakes up the whole debate.
And it shook the debate up. Why? I mean, obviously, I think I understand the answer. But I want you to explain it. Obviously, the fall of France was a shocking event. But why was that the event that sort of led to this dramatic change in thinking, or the beginning of a dramatic change in thinking?
Two elements. It transformed the balance of power in Europe. So it presented a situation in which Nazi Germany was master of Europe and became master of Europe within a very brief period of time. Furthermore, since it had seemed, at least for a moment, for several months, to have solved the mystery of offensive warfare that had eluded the powers in World War I, observers assumed that it was a good horse to bet on if you were, say, Italy, which then joined, and then Japan, which joined into the Tripartite Pact. And those who feared German power feared that it would then go on to conquer the British Isles and perhaps take the British fleet and the British Empire in the process. So it seemed for the foreseeable future that the Nazis would be the dominant power in Europe. And it wasn't just problematic from an American perspective that this was the case, but furthermore that the Axis powers were totalitarian powers. And so they were seen to represent a very different kind of world order of, you know, structuring society and engaging in relations across borders, including obviously in terms of trade. And so this specter of a German-dominated Europe presented Americans with basically an unprecedented situation. What did it mean for the United States that Europe and Asia could be dominated by hostile totalitarian powers in the future?
Right. So, and then you tell from that point, first of all, let me say, I think you'll agree with this. It seems entirely natural in the face of what you just described as that unprecedented set of events, the fact that offense seemed to be in the ascendance, that totalitarian Germany had taken over, was taking over Europe. It seems like those are exactly the kind of events that would have naturally led American foreign policy elites and the U.S. government to rethink its basic strategic engagement in the world. I mean, that's not surprising at that level, is it?
Absolutely not. No. And everybody in the United States was alarmed at this point. So including those who would go on to oppose U.S. entry in the war, if for no other reason than, you know, if the Germans were able to defeat Britain and take the British fleet, could the United States even guard the Western Hemisphere? So if you had a traditional aversion, you know, if you were an advocate of the Monroe Doctrine and wanted the United States to be the guardian of the New World and didn't necessarily think it was a U.S. security interest to be entangled in the old world, you still were alarmed by this situation because the United States had a one ocean navy and that navy was stationed in the Far East, not the Atlantic. And so Congress was nearly unanimous in approving the first ever draft in peacetime in the summer of 1940 and in approving a vast buildup of the U.S. Navy.
Right. But then the question became, how broadly, geographically, and in time, as you put it, does the United States need to assert itself militarily? And this is really the debate that you engage with. And you tell a really terrific story about how, well, I'm going to paraphrase and you can fill it in. They started off thinking we needed to control this much of the hemisphere and then the whole hemisphere. And then, well, we're going to need larger markets to make this work. And by the end of it, the logic had led them to think that the United States needed to be globally supreme, or at least globally supreme everywhere that the Germans weren't. Is that a fair summary?
That's right. And what you've described, this vast transformation in the area that post-war planners working in the Council on Foreign Relations thought that the United States needed to defend by force, that all happens, you know, from the summer of 1940 to October of 1940. So it's a really brief period of time. And what they imagined for the United States for their foreseeable future expands from less than the whole hemisphere initially, given the realities of U.S. power at that time. They start with a quarter sphere, and then Britain hangs on against the Nazi onslaught. And it also becomes clear that President Roosevelt and even non-interventionists in the American political system want the United States to at least defend the entire hemisphere. So then they start asking, all right, given that the United States is not about to be invaded anytime soon, its economy is prosperous, and that's not really in jeopardy fundamentally from events in Europe, especially after the Great Depression. The U.S. economy was so inward that it became more of a question of what do we really want? What is ideal? What is the best scope of U.S. interests and responsibilities in the world? And so by the fall of 1940, that's when the debate polarizes. And on the one hand, there's a coalition of Americans that gather under the banner of America First, who seek to preserve the U.S. non-entanglement position, arguing that the United States is secure in North America from any kind of transoceanic invasion as long as it defends the entire Western Hemisphere and denies to any outside invader a territorial foothold in the Western Hemisphere. They argued it just shouldn't go further. They are opposed by a set of foreign policy experts in places like the Council on Foreign Relations, as I mentioned, who think that's not enough, actually. That's not what we really want.
Okay, so let me ask you about, so an important part of your story is about the outsized role of these foreign policy elites at the CFR, at the Council on Foreign Relations, and at other places. So just tell us about, and then I want to ask you about how they labeled the former internationalists as isolationists. We'll get to that. But first, just tell us about, you know, who these people were, what their relationship was to the government, why they had this influence. And I think also this is one of the, I think many, but one of the main contributions, new contributions of your book is digging all this stuff up. Is that right?
Yeah, I think this is one of the reasons why the story that I've uncovered remained to be told. Old school diplomatic historians pay a lot of attention to reading the tea leaves of Franklin Roosevelt and his top advisors, and that matters. But before Pearl Harbor, before the United States was in the war, the U.S. government was very small, particularly when it came to foreign policy making. And what was much more significant was what we'd call today a foreign policy establishment in the making that had developed a little bit before World War I, but especially in the interwar period. And so it's ambitious experts in the Council on Foreign Relations who travel down to Washington just after the war in Europe breaks out in 1939 and propose to the State Department that, you know, they understand that the State Department is short-staffed. It can barely keep track of current events, let alone do far-sighted planning for the future. So they make a proposal, you know, let us do that planning on your behalf, at least as long as the United States isn't in the war. We've lined up the Rockefeller Foundation to give us funding to do this. And the State Department knew how to accept a good deal at that time. And so the real action, in my view, in the pre-Pearl Harbor period lies in this archipelago of, you might call them semi-official or unofficial foreign policy experts. In the case of the Council on Foreign Relations, I focus on that one because it was doing this work on behalf of the State Department and with some input by the State Department prior to Pearl Harbor. And a lot of these planners ended up transplanted into the official U.S. government post-war planning operation after Pearl Harbor. You know, that was a group of about 100 experts. I think they spent about $300,000 of the Rockefeller Foundation's money. And there were some really eminent people. It's a kind of distillation of the U.S. foreign policymaking class at that time. So one of the groups that they had in the economic and financial group was led by the leading Keynesian economist, the American Keynes, Alvin Hansen of Harvard, and his neoclassical rival, Jacob Viner of the University of Chicago.
And part of the strategy of, and I think this is one of the most interesting parts of the book, part of the strategy of this group and this foreign policy elite in the ascendance who were pushing an ever-expansive military role for the United States was to relabel the former group, the former conventional wisdom in the foreign policy elite, I think it's fair to say, who were kind of a form of internationalist. And you alluded to them earlier. They weren't against, this is the elites that prevailed in the first 30 years of the century, I think it's fair to say. You can correct any of this. They weren't anti-internationalist. They were anti-interventionist. They believed in international law. They believed in international dispute resolution. What they were against was a broad global footprint. And somehow or another, the CFR groups and the other groups in that side managed to paint the old internationalists as isolationists. How did that happen?
So I don't want to make it sound like a conspiracy. I don't think it was. What I think happened is that there used to be before the war a terrain where basically everybody considered themselves a nationalist or an internationalist, and the most common position was to claim to be both. And the question was, you know, how do you reconcile a sound nationalism with a sound internationalism, as Theodore Roosevelt once put it? And over the course of the 1930s, and especially toward the outset of World War II, some of these internationalists, many of them who were more comfortable with the League of Nations before, come to think that world order can only be secured through some kind of force. Perhaps that can be done initially through the British Empire with its combination, its alliance with France. And then when the British power structure comes under strain and the opportunity arises for the United States, they change their view, at least in terms of the agent that can undertake it. So after the fall of 1940, it becomes the United States at first, in tandem with Great Britain, that will be the new world ordering agent. And they see the other side, again, not because they're trying to, you know, just engage in bad faith political combat. That's not what's going on. But they fear a world of enclosure, of autarky, of separation, where, you know, totalitarians will be dominant in much of the world. The United States will be hunkered down or isolated in its hemisphere. Indeed, they, you know, cast hemispheric dominance by the United States as isolation. And essentially, they're willing to violate part of what had been internationalism, part of what had been foundational to internationalism, this injunction against participating in power politics, in order to preserve or put the United States in the best position to preserve liberal forms of intercourse around the globe. And others, in especially those who opposed U.S. intervention in World War II prior to Pearl Harbor, they make a different choice. They decide to stick with the traditional internationalist aversion to participation in power politics at the price of potentially allowing universal intercourse to go by the wayside, since, you know, that could end up leaving Europe to the worst Europeans and Asia to the worst Asians. And so in the course of this struggle, one side comes to the dominant side, the internationalist interventionist side, comes to brand the other side as isolationists. And they create this new conceptual structure and this new narrative of America's role in the world, in which the United States had always jostled between these competing impulses of isolationism and internationalism. And now it was the time to, you know, relegate isolationism to the ash heap of history where it belonged. That rendered global dominance, armed supremacy by the United States, as simultaneously the way to transcend power politics, even if by dominating power politics.
Okay, so this is one of the central claims in your book and one of the most interesting. And I didn't mean to suggest that you were painting this as a kind of conspiracy theory, but I do think it's fair to say that labeling the former internationalists as isolationists was part of the strategy of what you're describing as the internationalist interventionists, the ones who are in the ascendancy. Is that fair?
It's definitely fair, because especially after Pearl Harbor, at the orchestration of the State Department and other groups as well, there's a major campaign by U.S. foreign policy elites to rally the country around nominally membership in what becomes the UN Charter. But I think more profoundly, it's about trying to convince the public that a globe-spanning military role is the United States' new vocation. They are concerned to try to keep isolationism out, which they believe had scuttled world order after World War I. So there's a very concerted effort at that point to rally the country around internationalism and against isolationism.
Yes, but so this brings me up to a question I had throughout the book, and that is about the causal, this is just one version of it, the causal efficacy of ideas. Because in reading this account, which I found pretty persuasive, one wonders, was it the label isolationism that was doing the work, or was it the idea that the people who were called isolationists, the people who used to carry the mantle of internationalism, that their version of internationalism had just been widely perceived to be inadequate because, you know, of World War I and now what was going on in World War II. So how do you tease that out? I mean, I'm not sure that the label isolationism was doing any work or mattered that much as that the ideas that the people labeled isolationism, the positions and that they took just were much less convincing by that point.
I think I'm with you on that. Actually, one of the points I make toward the latter parts of the book is that when the elites embark on this massive campaign to rally the country against isolationism, they can barely even find representatives of so-called isolationism right. to pillory. After Pearl Harbor, those who had been opposed to U.S. entry in World War II were no longer. And so even a fellow like Robert Taft not only speaks in favor of joining the United Nations, but has some even more ambitious internationalist proposals to put forward himself. in the later years of the war. So there, I think, you know, what they say that they're doing, I think in their more candid moments, is they're trying to create a bulwark of public legitimacy that will last beyond 1945. Did that have a causal impact or not? You know, it's hard to say, those particular efforts, but I do think there's no question that this conceptual move of creating a whole new narrative where everybody understands, yes, the United States was once isolationist and fundamentally armed supremacy is the defining feature of American internationalism, of mere participation in the world. I think that has had very significant effects, and those effects last to our own day. But, you know, to your original point, I think in the crucial period of 1940 and 41, you know, although I am trying to write to recapture the sense of contingency that I think history deserves, that certainly actors at the time felt, they did not think that the outcome was predetermined. I do think that the position in the debate that held that the United States needed to get involved in World War II, needed to make sure that the Axis were defeated, and needed to play a more robust military in the role in the world afterward, was always stronger than the non-interventionist position. And the public opinion polls at the time suggested as much. So when the America First Committee was formed toward the end of 1940, by that point, about two-thirds of the public, according to these newfound Gallup polls, said it was more important to stop the Axis than to stay out of the war, even if very few Americans at that time wanted to enter the war officially.
Okay, you mentioned the United Nations. And again, a surprising thing for me in the book was the extent to which the kind of ascendant militarists, as I'll call them, that's my phrase, not yours, the extent to which they started off being against a kind of League of Nations II or a world organization to guarantee the peace. And then in a very short period of time before Pearl Harbor, I think you track the main intellectual movement between the Atlantic Charter and Pearl Harbor, how this group came to embrace the idea of world organization that ended up becoming what was the United Nations.
So in 1941, when members of the U.S. foreign policy elite came to the conclusion that only U.S. power could provide a sufficient basis for world order, they came to that conclusion precisely because they no longer believed that universalist schemes would be adequate. They lost faith in the League of Nations, which had been, for many of them, their project previously. They found that to be a toothless instrument. So the whole point of wanting the United States to play a dominant role led them to discard the idea of a world organization with universal membership as being of any value. So when Franklin Roosevelt meets with Winston Churchill off the coast of Newfoundland in August of 1941, and they put forward the Atlantic Charter, it looks very different from the document that they're echoing from Woodrow Wilson's 14 points from the previous war. And one of the major differences is that FDR refuses Churchill's suggestion to call in that charter for the establishment of an effective international organization. And I think my research provides some extra context to that. The post-war planners in the Council on Foreign Relations spent most of 1941 working out blueprints for the United States to police the world in an exclusive alliance with Great Britain, and specifically with the British Commonwealth or the White Settler Dominions. And so the point for them was to provide a real power structure, not dilute power into some universal organization. So in this work, they were modeling U.S. and what they called American-British world leadership against a world organization. So that threw up a new question for me. How do we get the United Nations then? The very thing that they seemed to be against through most of 1941. And so when I went to the National Archives and looked at now the post-war planners in the State Department, I found that there was a conscious decision worked out in the spring of 1942. They decided that it was really important for the United States to establish some kind of post-war world organization early in the post-war period, as soon as the war ended. And they didn't even really know what they wanted at this point. They hadn't worked out any of the details. That would come later. But their fear was that the U.S. public would provide an obstacle to the realization of U.S. global supremacy after the war, and that some kind of new League of Nations with modifications that would allow the United States to use it more as a vehicle for power, some kind of post-war organization would be really important for convincing the American people to project power in the post-war world. And that blew my mind because we're so used to seeing the United Nations as a form of constraint on American power. But I think it's quite powerful to revisit the reasons why these post-war planners thought that the opposite was more the case. They felt that there was a legitimacy problem for post-war U.S. leadership, partly because the Atlantic Charter, as the planners observed, fell like a dead duck in Congress and among the public, and was even accused by, you know, people like John Foster Dulles, no isolationist he, the future Cold Warrior Secretary of State. He reacted against the Atlantic Charter at the time, calling it a scheme for Anglo-Saxon military and economic hegemony. So they knew they had a legitimacy problem. And their solution, and this comes back to what you were talking about, the installation of this new narrative in which internationalism is opposed to isolationism, the symbol of internationalism, the great symbol, would be the creation of this new world organization, which could actually help the United States to project hegemonic power in the future more than it would provide a constraint.
So I just want to underscore, you just said this, but I want to underscore it to make it clear. There are two surprising claims there. One is that the planners of the United Nations on the U.S. side saw it as a way to enhance and ensure the global militarism project that they had in mind. And two, that the main reason they were pushed in that direction was the need for domestic legitimacy, because they were worried that the U.S. public at the end of the war would fall back into a less interventionist posture, and that some kind of legitimation for global militarism or a global presence like the United Nations would help assuage that. Is that basically right?
I think that's exactly right. You know, they might have gotten to something like the UN anyway, just given that the Soviet Union ended up hanging on and, you know, became part of the Grand Alliance. I think, you know, FDR, even before he becomes an advocate of a universal United Nations in 1943, he's already expanding, you know, from the big two, the US and the UK, to the Soviet Union, and thinking about including France and thinking about including China in his great power policeman. But, you know, I think we have to explain the specifically universal form of the United Nations. That, I think, comes back to this very issue of creating legitimacy amongst the wider public.
So that thesis strikes me as almost exactly the opposite thesis of the one offered by Ona Hathaway and Scott Shapiro in their book, The Internationalists, which you reviewed in The Nation several years ago. Do you think that's a fair, I mean, it can one see the claims that we just discussed as a kind of, I'm not saying this is what motivated you, but as a kind of rejoinder to their thesis about the rise of the United Nations as a kind of a rise of global legal constraint?
I think that's more or less correct. I mean, they do something innovative themselves. It's often said that the UN was a kind of, you know, obvious move for the United States in World War II because, you know, the League of Nations had failed and it wanted to kind of have a do-over of World War II. And Hathaway and Shapiro focus us instead on the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928 as an inspiration. But, you know, I think we do fundamentally disagree, and we kind of start from the same place. We start by taking quite seriously the pre-World War II generation of internationalists who thought they believed, you know, who said they believed that something like public opinion could be the ultimate guarantor of world order. That's why this Kellogg-Briand Pact appealed to someone like James Shotwell, this historian and transatlantic networker who does go on to be one of the players in World War II who designs the UN Charter. But then we have a different story to tell. Hathaway and Shapiro see the United Nations and the 1945 settlement as deriving from the Kellogg-Briand Pact model. So they see a kind of culmination of the prior internationalism in 1945. And I see something very different. I see the fundamental aspiration of internationalism, that of transcending power politics, going by the wayside after the Nazis conquer France. And so the UN for me is a much more ornamental body. And, you know, its very purpose is to get the United States to project hegemonic power rather than take a bold step forward to order the world by a system of rules.
So the story was powerfully told. The part of it I didn't really understand is why there was such a consent. If the UN Charter was designed, at least from the US perspective, to be a way to project hegemonic power for the United States, I mean, why was someone like Robert Taft okay with it? You talk about Taft acquiescing. You talk about the Republican who was most against sort of global militarism in the middle of the 20th century. Why was Charles Beard so sanguine about it, said no big deal? I mean, it was, I can't remember, I think the vote was 97-2
yeah,
in the Senate. I mean, was it seen? It wasn't, I don't think it was seen at the time publicly as this way for the United States to project power, or it couldn't have been, had such consensus even among the former skeptics of militarism, global militarism, or am I missing something?
Well, I think you're right. I think it was a symbolic creation, and it was intended to be largely symbolic. So if you were a true believer, you might say, in the League of Nations, you had good reason to think that the UN was a disappointment, as some couple marginal figures, they did. The sticking point over U.S. membership in the League of Nations after World War I had been guarantees over sanctions like Article 10, which at least on the surface seemed to require member states to enforce the peace, to repel an assault by another country on the territorial integrity of a League member. This had really offended many in the Senate. And the United Nations is, from that perspective, you know, almost consciously a debating society. There's no real positive requirement for the United States to do much. And that was purposeful. It was purposeful, first of all, because at that point, U.S. foreign policymakers didn't really believe that fundamentally any system of rules were going to solve the problem of world order. And also because they were very worried about a resurgence of what they called isolationism after the war. And so they didn't want to, in a sense, they didn't want to put forward a scheme that was so burdensome, you might say so meaningful, that it would run into intense opposition. So the UN was really kind of an empty vessel as it was intended to be.
Okay, last question on your book, and then I want to talk about implications. And that question is, you know, you paint this picture of what we've just described as a choice, a self-conscious choice made by the United States at a particular period of time to shift towards global militarism. And it's largely a story of ideas. Obviously, the world was changing. But I guess I'm wondering, you know, that's one choice. If that was really a choice, what were the other choices? What were the counterfactual choices that the United States could have made? It seems to me that as World War II goes on, as the United States sees the threat of global totalitarianism, as it's built up this huge military, as its economic power is at its height, I mean, what were the choices? Was there really a choice in 1944, 1945 to go back to the old version of internationalism? Was that really a realistic option?
Well, it could have been. At that point, it was not put forward. And so as a historian, what I consider counterfactuals, I want to find some actors at the time who put forward a certain path. And there aren't many you can point to as of 1944 and 45.
But if I could just interject there before you go on, but why doesn't that count against the case that this was a choice? I mean, it just seems so obvious to everyone that this was the right step forward. The fact that you can't find anyone arguing for the alternative makes me think it really wasn't a choice as you painted it, or at least not quite the way you painted it.
I agree. As of 1944 and 1945, there's no real choice. There's no real meaningful debate, even as all these elites are, you know, really nervous about and excited over the UN. The choice, the moment of decision comes in 1940 and 41. And there was a real choice. And it was well articulated and litigated, at least over the question of whether the United States should enter the war, though that implied something about the post-war period as well. And so, you know, there, I think, is the source of things could have gone differently. You know, if somehow Robert Taft had gotten the Republican nomination, he failed. Maybe he failed for important reasons. But if he had gotten the Republican nomination in 1940 and become president, the coalition that had formed to oppose U.S. entry into World War II had a coherent theory of the case to put forward. I'm not saying that either the United States or the world would have looked better had that happened. Not at all. But they did, however, provide valuable resources in terms of articulating a coherent limitation on the use of American force. And so I think once we as a country lost any sense of this kind of old internationalist view that there should be a limitation on the use of force, that it would be useful to define U.S. vital interests in a rigorous way. Once we lost that resource, that very part of the debate, and stigmatized it as isolationist and beyond the pale, we were then down a kind of tragic path of, you know, perhaps doing a lot of good in the world for a period of time, but also ending up in the position of making war endlessly. And I think in our own time, global military dominance has become something like an end in itself. And so once totalitarianism passes from the earth, the project that had been conceived under very different circumstances in the middle of the 20th century, in my mind, becomes a lot less justifiable than it was originally.
Okay, let me just press you one more time on that set of arguments, and then we'll move to normative implications. So I just don't see, I mean, we can't know, but if Taft had won the election, given world events that occurred, can we really be confident that the United States wouldn't have gone down the same path because of the nature of the threat, especially after Japan bombs Pearl Harbor? This is a period in which there was a scramble for the bomb. I mean, I just don't understand. And then also, I don't understand why these events, it just seems to me to be a bit of a causal stretch to go from these ideas between 1940 and 1945. You acknowledge that by 45, there's no choice. That's basically, it's set. What could the United States have done differently? Are you talking about maybe we shouldn't have supported Great Britain as well as we did? Should we have not done Lend-Lease? Should we have not done the destroyers for bases? But what would the alternate steps have been that would have taking the United States away from this precipice towards militarism?
Let me give you two different answers to that question. So one, we could have done exactly what we did in exactly the way we did it in World War II and seen that war through to absolute victory. Winning the war did not need to imply a long-term project of the United States appointing itself the supreme military power. That didn't have to happen. And indeed, in World War I, the United States declined to join the League of Nations and to you know, envision itself in the role of policeman of Europe, even though it did end up joining World War I. So in actual fact, what my book shows is that for those who favored outright intervention in the war prior to Pearl Harbor, that question was closely bound up with a longer-term, future-oriented question about America's general role in the world. They drew conclusions about the very nature of international society from the fall of France, from the rise of totalitarians, that, you know, served them well, and I think served the world pretty well for a period of time. And the question I want to pose in terms of our present moment is, does it serve either the United States or the world very well now? The other answer to your question would go back to the position put forward by those who opposed intervention in the war. So they offered a coherent theory of the case. They said that, you know, most of them were very anti-totalitarian, anti-Nazi, and anti-Soviet. But they said the United States is fundamentally secure between its oceans. And in fact, the United States should defend the entire Western Hemisphere. And that would provide security for the United States. And they couldn't see a good reason to go beyond that. They looked at technological change and said, wait a minute, the United States, the world is not becoming more interconnected such that, you know, events in Europe impact the United States more. Take the advent of air power. Air power actually helped, they argued, to defend against an invasion across the seas more than it would help the invading country. An invading country could, you know, send bombers to make some mischief, but it couldn't actually achieve its goals. And so when Britain held on against the Luftwaffe toward the end of 1940 and into 1941, the non-interventionists said, hey, look, this is proof of what we've been saying. If the English Channel affords Britain the ability to hang on, you know, imagine what the Atlantic Ocean can do for the United States. So their vision of the case was, and I'm not endorsing it, I am trying to crystallize what the choices were to Americans at the time. But their vision was that the United States could live at peace in the Western Hemisphere, guard the entire Western Hemisphere, not have much of a sacrifice in terms of prosperity. And they hoped that, you know, the Axis powers would face opposition in Europe and Asia, just as, you know, prior aspirants to hegemony in Eurasia had overstretched themselves. And there had been a system of shifting alliances in Europe and Asia. And they figured, given that the United States was not under any direct threat from events in Europe, that the United States could maintain this traditional attitude.
So, I mean, it sounds like, you know, you barely talk about the Cold War in your book because the kind of your timeline stops before the Cold War got going. But it sounds like one implication is this of your claim is, I'm not saying it's entailed by your claim, but it is that there's a serious possibility that the Cold War was a mistake and could have been avoided.
Well, I think as of 1945, as of the, you know, given the political consensus that I described coming out of World War II, I think something like the Cold War was, I hate to use the word inevitable, but, you know,
yeah,
I'm going in that direction.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So then really it really was the choice to get involved in World War II the way we did, and these ideas towards militarism that were percolating that you think led to being in this inevitable position in 45. I guess that's what your claim is.
The choice was not just to get involved in World War II, but also that the United States had a responsibility to enforce world order, and that was a kind of perpetual project that the United States had to undertake.
Okay, let's get to normative implications. The book is a work of history and international relations and domestic politics, and there's no overt normative claim in the book, as best I could tell. You have a little bit of discussion of modern times in the conclusion. But you're a prominent writer against modern global militarism by the United States, and you have a senior position at the Quincy Institute. I want you to tell us what that is. And I just want to understand, just give us a sense of what the relationship, if any, is between the arguments in this book and your views on modern global militarism. And why don't you just tell us what those are?
Sure. Well, I have a tragic view of the story I tell in the book. So I can't help but look with sympathy at those who wanted the United States to get into World War II as soon as possible and stop the Nazis. I'm all for that. And in fact, it was being troubled by the complexity of this story that drew me to write the book in the first place. So what I think has happened is, because the United States made this choice for global dominance, reconceived its entire role in the world, casting anything but dominance as so-called isolationism, we've gone down a path since 1991 that has been quite destructive for ourselves and for the world. The premise of the argument for global dominance that I uncover in the book was that there's a force out there, a totalitarian force, that can close off the world to a decent form of intercourse and understanding and legal order and so forth. After 1991, the United States, you know, felt that its dominance had been a success, understandably so. But the upshot of that for American officials and intellectuals was that the United States, you know, couldn't declare victory and go home. It needed once again to avoid isolationism and extend its dominance more than ever. And it's been three decades now, and totalitarianism has not resurfaced, certainly not in the form, I think, of anything like what the Axis powers posed or Soviet-backed communism. We can have a discussion about China in that regard, because I think that's the big question today. But for most of this post-Cold War period, the United States was dominating not to counteract, you know, something like the totalitarian powers of old, but because U.S. policymakers believed that this was the only real way the United States could relate to the world, even in the absence of threats. And so what we've seen is a record that's been quite destructive. It's not just the Iraq War of 2003 that finally, we all now, I guess, agree that it was a terrible mistake, with notable exceptions. But the United States has used armed force far more frequently after the Cold War than it did during the Cold War itself. So I'm very concerned about what our future looks like if the policymaking class in Washington is wedded to global military dominance as the only way it can conceive of America's role in the world, and anyone who seems to call for prudent retrenchment is labeled, you know, an isolationist and unthinkable. I really worry about where things go from here for the rest of the 21st century. We've already seen the United States' unipolar moment deteriorate since the late 1990s. I expect that, you know, that kind of relative decline or a shift toward multipolarity will continue, and so do others. And so I think if we don't have a more robust debate about the real foreign policy choices we face, not some fiction of internationalism versus isolationism, we're headed for trouble. And in that trouble could be a great power war. So that insight, I guess, motivated me to be one of the people who co-founded this new organization, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft.
Okay, so let me ask you about how you see things, what Donald Trump's role in all this is. It seems remarkable to me, I think you've pointed this out, others have, that the last two presidents who've won, Barack Obama and Donald Trump, both ran against, in some real sense, the kind of the blob mentality in Washington, the global militarism mentality that has a kind of bipartisan appeal. Obama did that in the context of criticizing the Iraq War and promising a smaller footprint abroad. He was not hugely successful in that. And he, you know, Libya happened on his watch. The rise of war at a distance and drones happened on his watch. Then Trump comes in and really took on his party in kind of an extraordinary way. He criticized in a debate the Iraq War, and all the Republican establishment on that debate stage came after him, and it was a very popular position. And then he criticized Hillary Clinton for her militaristic tendencies during the presidential campaign, and he won. And then, I mean, Trump is obviously incompetent in many ways in wielding executive power, and he has engaged in some military aggressiveness, probably not as much as his predecessors, the last two, I think. But whatever he's done as president, it seems like we're about, assuming that Trump loses, we're recording this about 10 or 11 days before the election, assuming, as people seem to think is going to happen now, that Trump loses, it seems like that the consensus is going to win out and continue. I mean, Biden has talked a little bit about, and he's really been kind of pulling back from the traditional Democrat position on neoliberalism, but I don't think he has really stated any broad claims about withdrawing the American footprint. In fact, he wants to reengage internationalism, as he puts it. So I guess my question is, how do you see things going now? I mean, and if assuming Biden wins, what do you expect to happen?
I think we are emerging from a historic period of depoliticization of American foreign policy. We had this moment or this decade of the 1990s where it wasn't just the end of history, it was also a holiday from history in the sense of trade-offs. The United States could cut its military spending as a percentage of GDP and find itself coming into the millennium with greater relative military dominance than ever before, at least in the view of many who were writing at that time. And now we're seeing the return of constraints, and we're seeing public discontent over the war on terror and the so-called endless wars that have accompanied them. And you're absolutely right, I think, in the chronology. For more than a decade now, in the moments where we have something of a meaningful national conversation about America's role in the world, namely primary battles, it's been the more anti-war candidates or those who claim to be anti-war who have gotten great traction from that position. So candidates who are running for anything right now, I think, are taking good note of where the public is on these issues. So I see Trump, his presidency, the fact that he was elected in the first place, as a symptom of a crisis of legitimacy of American global supremacy. Trump, when he ran in 2016, was roundly decried by the foreign policy making class in Washington, both parties, as an isolationist. And, you know, it seems as though voters either didn't care or felt that that was exactly the confirmation they wanted, that Trump would truly be different once in office. In actual fact, I think he hasn't been all that different. And he also ran always promising to build up the supposedly depleted U.S. military such that we now spend more than the next 10 militaries combined. So, you know, he's not really an anti-interventionist, but certainly he has appealed to that sentiment in his runs for office. So I think this long-term trend will continue. The new sense that we have to deal with constraints, we have to face real trade-offs, that I think is going to continue. It's going to continue because of the relative rise of China in particular, and it's also going to continue because of our domestic politics, because of all the discontent and needs that the American people have at home. So, you know, where does Joe Biden fit into this, assuming he does emerge victorious from the election? I'm not sure. He's certainly an establishment creature, as far as I can tell. But even he in the Democratic primary found himself kind of like Hillary Clinton 4 years before, trying to accentuate the less bellicose aspects of his agenda. He's, for example, said that he wants to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. He has said he wants to end the forever war, although, as I understand it, the stated position is to remove most ground troops from Afghanistan and the greater Middle East. I'm not sure
most relative to what exactly, but I expect that, you know, he will be responsive to forces in public opinion and in the Democratic Party. So for me, the real question looking at the short term now, at the next 4 years, let's say, isn't so much, you know, what will a Biden administration do left to its own devices? It's what will the force of circumstances and the political logic, what kind of trade-offs will those throw up for the administration, as well as what will those who want to see a less militaristic U.S. foreign policy, what will they do to organize and make their views heard? I think under the Obama administration, there was a kind of demobilization of voices from the left, at least, because, you know, they felt that Obama was probably the best they could get at that time. And maybe that was correct, given the constantly hawkish criticisms of the Obama administration coming from Congress, indeed coming from both parties. But my sense is that things have really shifted starting from the end of the Obama administration. And now, after 4 years of Trump, I think there's a lot more openness to really asking, why are our priorities the way they are? What does it mean that a president like Donald Trump can come to be commander in chief of the world's greatest military? And, you know, if he wanted to, you know, he could order a nuclear strike at will. I think these are pretty powerful arguments, including for people who are in the center of the Democratic Party. And there's another factor also, which is the climate crisis, which the Trump administration hasn't taken bold action on, to say the least. We're now in a real moment of decision on that. And I think that has pretty profound implications for U.S. choices toward China and will tend to be a moderating factor in decisions that a Biden administration might make as to exactly how intense does it want rivalry with China to be.
Okay, Stephen, thank you very much and congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, and socks. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.